about their lives and lose some weight and get healthy and all that sort of stuff. And they do this in teams to try and kind of get points, and they're all competing for a prize at the end. Anyway, this ad, I'm sure you've seen it. It's been on lots of times. There's a team of a girl, the guy with the pink mohawk, and a girl with him, and he's blindfolded, and he's running along, and she's running next to him, and he's running kind of in an obstacle course, and it's her job to tell him, you know, what's coming up and how to negotiate the obstacle course. Anyway, he's running along, and there's a big kind of pile of logs there, and he's running, and just about as he's about to get, she says, oh, there's a log, and he goes, bang, face first into the pile of logs. I've seen that ad about 20 times. About 20 times I've rolled on the floor laughing. I never get sick of seeing it. It's hilarious. It's really funny to see, unless you're the one running, of course. Then it's not so funny. But I reckon life can feel a little bit like that sometimes. You're running. You're running at pace. There's lots of things happening, and you've got to get from here to there, and then this is on, and the next thing's on, and you're running, but it's kind of like you're running in the dark because you just don't know what's coming. You don't know if the phone's going to ring and what sort of news that's going to get that's going to explode your nice sort of comfortable routine out of the water. There's always the fear that you're going to run smack bang into something that's going to floor you. And people come up with all sorts of strategies to try and deal with running in the dark. Some people decide not to run much at all. They decide to stay pretty still and not engage much. Other people just run everywhere. They don't care what they run into or what damage kind of gets left in their wake. Other people try and listen to voices that to help them. I used to work way back ago in a children's shoe store. And when it got quiet, you'd kind of gather around and chat about life and everything. And some of the ladies that I worked with in that shop would religiously go and buy a bunch of the women's kind of magazines and check out the stars, seriously looking for guidance to help them run the next week in the dark. Other people listen to all sorts of voices on talkback radio or the TV or what they read in the newspaper or blogs or Twitter or whatever. They find a loud voice and they listen to that. Now, friends, we're in a new series of talks called Run. And we're looking at what God has to say to us in the final chapters of the book of Hebrews. Hebrews is an amazing book. Up to our section, the writer to the Hebrews lays out what God has done for us in the person of Jesus in all sorts of ways. One of the main things Jesus has done for us in the Old Testament, when people sinned, that would break their relationship with God. And God said, if you sin, someone's got to pay for that. And so you would take an animal of some sort and you would slit its throat and the blood would pour out. And that blood would be a punishment, a payment for your sin to restore your relationship with God. And the writer to Hebrews says that Jesus has come as the one true, final, once for all sacrifice for sin. No more animals need to be killed. No more blood needs to be spilt. The blood of Jesus that was spilt is the ultimate sacrifice so that our sin is covered if we put our faith in him. In the old covenant, people would need to go to a priest in order to make sure that they could have a relationship with God. The priest was like the middleman between them and God. He was a mediator. But now Jesus has come as the great priest, the great high priest, who can cleanse us and restore us to an intimate, permanent relationship with God. We don't need any other middleman to have a relationship with God now. All this has been done for us. But when the writer gets to our final chapters of the book of Hebrews, he says, on the basis of all that stuff that's been done for you in Jesus, then run. That we heard John set out for us last week. It's an image taken from the games that were performed in front of the emperor. The picture there is of someone running to try and please the one who is in control. Well, the writer says, God's in control. So run for him. But the question there is, how do you run in the dark? How do you run when you can't see the future? How do you run when you don't know what's coming? It's all very well for an athlete in the games because they're in a stadium and they can see the track and they'll run around it and they might do another lap and around. They know exactly where they're going. But how do you run when you can't see where the track goes or what the obstacles are? Well, to help us with that question, the writer to the Hebrews has assembled some people in the grandstand who are witnesses watching us run the race. And in that grandstand, those witnesses provide for us trustworthy voices to give us guidance as they yell out to us in our race. They help us to know how to run in the dark. So we're going to hear now three voices that can help us to run confidently when we can't see. You might like to turn it open. It's Hebrews chapter 11, and Leanne's going to read it for us.
Starting at Hebrews chapter 10, verse 35. So do not throw away your confidence. It will be richly rewarded. You need to persevere so that when you have done the will of God, you will receive what he has promised. For in just a very little while, he who is coming will come and will not delay, but my righteous one will live by faith. And if he shrinks back, I will not be pleased with him. But we are not of those who shrink back and are destroyed, but of those who believe and are saved. Now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. By faith, we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. By faith, Abel offered God a better sacrifice than Cain did. By faith, he was commanded as a righteous man when God spoke well of his offerings. And by faith, he still speaks, even though he is dead. By faith, Enoch was taken from this life so that he did not experience death. He could not be found because God had taken him away. For before he was taken, he was commended as one who pleased God. And without faith, it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. By faith, Noah, when warned about things not yet seen, in holy fear, built an ark to save his family. By his faith, he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness that comes by faith. Chapter 12, verse 1. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us.
Thank you. So there's that image picked up there in chapter 12, verse 1. Since we're surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, that's the array of people in the grandstand, the voices that we're going to hear tonight and in the weeks to come. Now, it's good to be reminded that the original readers of Hebrews, it's likely that they were in Rome. They were under intense pressure in their worshipping of Jesus. They're probably in Rome around about the time of Nero. And that you know, if you know your basic ancient history, Nero led a great big fire in Rome and wanted to blame someone else for it to take the pressure off himself. And so the Christians became the targets. And he set his kind of secret police out to get the Christians. And so this became known. And so Christians then in Rome were under intense pressure. Will I keep following Jesus? Will I keep standing up for him? Or will I just go back and pretend that I'm one of the Jews and the Jews aren't under pressure and I'll just go back and worship in the synagogues there and then the heat won't be on me? The pressure is really on. Are they going to stand for Jesus? Are they going to persevere in their running of the race or not? And so to encourage them to not let go of their faith, to keep their confidence, even as they're running into the dark, this writer assembles the witnesses. And so we're going to hear from these three voices tonight. Three things to help us with our run. The first voice is Abel. And Abel shouts to us, approval is a gift. not a right. Approval is a gift, not a right. Now, who was Abel? Well, Abel was one of Adam and Eve's boys. In fact, he was their second born. And we hear about Abel and his older brother in Genesis 4. And we read there, now Abel kept flocks and Cain worked the soil. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord. But Abel brought fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked on favor with Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering, he did not look with favor. So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it." Now Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let's go out to the field." And while they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. Now what's going on here? You've got two brothers. They both bring something. One brings something from the land, some sort of crops, some sort of, you know, vegetable offering. One brings meat. God says yes to the meat and says no to the land offering. Is God more of a steak guy than a salad guy? I mean, what's going on here? The key to understanding what's going on is in our text that we heard from Hebrews 11. Have a look with me, verse 4. By faith, Abel offered God a better sacrifice than Cain did. By faith, he was commended as a righteous man when God spoke well of his offering. And by faith, he still speaks even though he's dead. The point is how they approached God. Not what they brought, but how they approached God. Abel came to God with nothing in his hands, even though he was probably carrying a big animal. Metaphorically, he came with nothing in his hands to show God. His sacrifice was an expression of trust in God's mercy towards him. There is nothing that he had done on his own, by his own merit. He came humbly hoping for the gift of God's approval, trusting in God's character that he would give it to him. And because he came in humility, because he came in trust to God with nothing in his hands, God gave him the approval that he was after. God commended him as a righteous man, we're told in Hebrews. Cain came with a different approach. Cain came to prove how worthy he was of God's approval. His offering was not an expression of humble dependence on God. His offering was a demonstration to God of his righteousness, which therefore demanded God's approval. Approval was his right. He should have it. Or so he thought. But his way of thinking was exposed. It's a bit like a story I heard recently. Once upon a time, there was a gardener who grew an enormous carrot. So he took it to his king and he said, "My lord, this is the greatest carrot that I've ever grown or will ever grow. I want to present it to you as a token of my love and respect for you." The king was touched and he discerned the man's heart. And so as he turned to go, the king said to him, "Wait. You're clearly a good steward of the earth. I own a plot of land next to yours. I want to give it to you freely as a gift so that you can garden all of it." And the gardener was amazed and delighted and went home rejoicing. But there was a noble man at the king's court who overheard all of this. And he said, "If that's what you get for a carrot, imagine if he gave the king something better." So the next day, the nobleman came before the king and he was leading a handsome black stallion. He bowed low and he said, "My lord, I breed horses. And this is the greatest horse I have ever bred or ever will breed. Therefore, I wanted to present it to you as a token of my love and respect for you. But the king discerned his heart, and he said, thank you, and took the horse and merely dismissed him. The nobleman was perplexed. So the king said, let me explain. The gardener was giving me the carrot, but you were giving yourself the horse. This is such an easy trap for anyone to fall into. Churches, I think, are full of these sorts of people who think approval from God is a right. Oh, yeah, look, Jesus died for people's sins. Yep, and so there's mercy, you know, there's forgiveness. But look at my life. I mean, God will have to approve of me. Just look at how I've been going. There are two classic signs that you may have drifted, that I may have drifted into this way of thinking. The first sign is that you find yourself judging other people. Can you believe what Sophie's doing? I mean, as if you would do that. Who would do that? I would never do that. If you find yourself having those sorts of conversations where you're just judging someone and making sure that you're climbing up a little bit on top of them, you might be in danger of your heart trying to demand God's approval of you. God, I wouldn't do that. Look at me. Give it to me. The other sign that you might be slipping into this way of thinking is what you do if your plans get thwarted. If you find yourself getting really angry with God when things don't go your way, that's a warning sign. You plan for things to go like this. You think you can see the road ahead, and then God doesn't deliver. And you get angry. This is not right, God. This is not the contract. I perform, you deliver. I mean, I have rights. Cain got so angry that things didn't go his way that he killed his brother. The only way to run into the future, friends, is fully resting on God's approval as a gift. It comes as a gift to you and to me only through the death of Jesus in our place for our sins. Approval is a gift, not a right. That's Abel's voice to help us as we run into the dark. The second voice we hear in this passage is that of Enoch. Enoch says to us, run like a true believer with head and hands and heart. Run like a true believer with head and hands and heart. Who was Enoch? Enoch was the son of Jared and the father of Methuselah. That just about clears it up for you, doesn't it? We actually don't know a lot more about him. We know a little bit, but not a lot more. And so you might be asking, well, what's he doing here? I mean, in this chapter, with the witnesses in the grandstand, you've got the great ones. You've got a Moses and an Abraham and a David. What's Enoch doing here when we don't really know that much about him? Well, the answer is in the next few verses from Hebrews 11. Have a look at me, verse 5. By faith, Enoch was taken from this life so that he did not experience death. He could not be found because God had taken him away. For before he was taken, he was commended as one who pleased God. And without faith, it's impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. We're told that Enoch's faith pleased God. So much so that God didn't let Enoch even taste death. He took him away before he died. So what was it about this faith that pleased God? Well, you see it there in our passage. He says that he believes that God exists. Do you believe that God exists? Now, that might sound like a silly question to a bunch of people sitting in a church. But people, you might be here for all sorts of reasons. You might be here because a family member's dragged you here tonight. You might be here because you're checking out stuff. You might be here because this has been your custom to just kind of rock along. You've done this since you were a little one, and here you are. But do you believe God actually exists? I can tell what you truly believe by what you do. You see, true belief does involve your intellect, your brain, your head. If I tell you right now that a bomb exists underneath one of the seats here and that it's primed to go off sometime before 8:30, you're going to have to use your head to work out whether that's true or not. You're going to look at me and you go, okay, would I believe what he's saying? Is what he's saying possible? Yeah, it's possible. Is what he's saying, is it likely? Has he have a history of pulling these sort of pranks before? Or has he completely flipped? You're going to have to work that out with your head. You're going to have to use your reason. But true belief is more than just an intellectual decision. True belief involves your hands. You see, I can't see inside your head, but I can tell whether you believe that there's a bomb exists in this building or not. It's going to go off before 8:30. If you get up and leave in a real hurry, I'll know what you truly believe about the bomb. I'll know that you believe that the bomb actually exists. True belief has consequences that result in action. A head assent leads to an action. But belief in a person involves yet another dimension as well. It involves your heart. It involves a commitment. Let me take a more personal example. A lady named Rebecca made a promise that she would always love me and never leave me. And I believed her. You can tell that I believed her because I made the same promise to her, forsaking the thousands of other women who, you know, would have loved to have had a chance. And I joined my whole life. You're laughing a little bit too much, actually. I joined my whole life to her nearly 18 years ago. The true belief in God has all of those elements. True faith has all of those elements. God is real. He exists, and there are good reasons for believing that, and that flows through into the actions that I do in my life and into a commitment to a person. And Enoch's faith demonstrated all of those things. In the couple of verses that we have on him in Genesis 5, we're told twice that he walked with God. He walked with God. The writer of Genesis wants us to see that. You've got a couple of lines on Enoch and uses two times, he walked with God, day by day, listening to God, living for God, committed to God. He believed in him, he loved him, and his actions demonstrated that reality. And that is how Enoch tells us to run into the future with God. He says, if you want to run, you want to run this race, Enoch says, you want to run it, you've got to run it full on for God, with everything that you've got. Let your whole life show who you're running for. Let your words show it. Let your actions show it. Let your diaries show it. Let your relationships show it. Let your commitments, let your actions show it. You want to live full on, says Enoch to us. And if you do that, then your feet will stay on the path. In fact, a life sold out for Jesus is the only way to please God. A life sold out for Jesus is the only way to run home. So Enoch says to us, run like a true believer with head and hands and heart. And the third and final voice that we hear from the grandstand tonight is that of Noah. And Noah says, hey, listen, running by promises doesn't look normal. Running by promises doesn't look normal. We're told there in verse 7, by faith, Noah, when warned about things not yet seen, in holy fear, built an ark to save his family. By his faith, he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness that comes by faith. Now, most people here, I'm guessing, have heard of Noah. He's told by God to build a boat to save all the animals, samples of all the animals, from a flood that God was yet to send. And Noah obeyed. A flood. It's going to wipe out the whole earth. Noah goes, yep, I reckon that's going to happen. I reckon you're right. Where's the wood? Where's my hammer? Where's my nails? Whatever they used. And he starts building a boat. Despite appearances, despite what was normal around him, everyone else is eating and drinking and getting married and having feasts and getting on with their life. Noah's out there with the wood building a boat. Can you imagine the ridicule? Hey, there's that guy, he's building a boat on dry land. Good luck launching that. Tell us when that's happening. We'd love to see that. Oh, sorry, you're looking a bit stern. You better bow down now before you flood the place with tears. I mean, all careful, guys, getting a bit cranky. Might arc up. But, you know, he ran the course of his life trusting in the promises anyway. Looking weird. Cutting against the grain of the culture around him. And he was rewarded for that kind of trust. Because the promises that came from God, who is completely trustworthy and always keeps his word. Now, friends, we may not know the details of the future, every step of the road that God has laid out for us. But God has promised the future to us who trust in Jesus. And he calls on each one of us to run the race based on promises. On the things we have not yet seen, because they've been spoken by God, and it is as if they are real already. And if you do that, you won't look normal. I'm part of a cricket club. I coach my boys playing cricket, and our cricket club has all sorts of fundraisers that are big booze ups. It has stuff that runs on Sundays all the time, and I can't go to that. I can't go to those things, and I look really weird as part of the cricket club. Now, I get some heat for that. Running by promises doesn't look normal. When I told my bosses that I was going to leave work after being given a lucrative deal, offered a lucrative deal to go and start a business in Melbourne and make lots and lots of money, and I told them, no, we're going to Bible college because I'm going to be a minister. I was the subject of the company joke for the next year that I was there until I left. Because running on promises doesn't look normal. You may choose not to take a promotion sometime in the future because money's a real issue for you. You love to have it. You love the feeling of power when you've got it. You love the sense of freedom that you can choose to buy this or this or this, and I can have the latest of this when it comes out. And you might choose to say, I don't want to give in to that temptation. I don't want that temptation in my life. I'm going to stay doing this. And when you do that, you won't look normal. You may choose to say no to stuff that's been offered to you, to a lifestyle that you're still exposed to. You may choose to stay with your husband or stay with your wife when it's really hard. And if you do that, you won't look normal to all the voices saying, just leave, it's all about you. You may choose not to steal from work when it's really easy to do and no one would ever know. And you won't look normal. None of that behavior is normal. And if you let it be known that you're a follower of Jesus, you won't look normal. And in perhaps over the coming years in Australia, in the next 10, 20 years, you will look even more abnormal as Christianity keeps getting flogged and flayed in the public square. You won't look normal. But the promises are sure. In fact, they are the one true beacon of light on the dark path that lies ahead of each one of us. And so run on the promises. This year's an Olympics year. And no doubt, even now, all of our potential Olympic athletes are living every single day on purpose. From the time that they wake up, from the time that they've set their alarm is on purpose. Their waking time is on purpose. Every single morsel of food that goes into their body is measured and carefully weighed out and is on purpose. Everything they drink is on purpose. The amount of time they spend exercising as opposed to in the weight room, as opposed to resting, as opposed to with the sports psychologist getting their head right, as opposed to all of that stuff. Everything they do is on purpose. So that when the time comes, they can run. They can run. Friends, are we living every day on purpose for Jesus? This is the call from Hebrews. Since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Even when we can't see the future. And these witnesses in the grandstand, they're cheering us on every day. Rest in God's approval. Head and heart and hands leads to the greatest possible reward. The promises are sure. The promises are sure. The promises are sure. Run on them, even though you don't look normal. And when we stumble, Jesus the rescuer is there to right us. And if we fall and get filthy, then Jesus the great high priest is there to cleanse us afresh. And if we get afraid of the dark or lose our way in the dark, then Jesus, the light of the world, is there to show us the way and take us all the way home. So let us run. Let me pray. Gracious Father, we do thank you that in your mercy you have sent Jesus. You've revealed yourself to us in him. You've revealed yourself as the God who loves us, who's saved us, who's washed us, who has the greatest possible reward for us. And so in the light of all those things, you call us to run with perseverance, not to shrink back when the heat is on, when people are jibing us or when we're tempted, not to give in to those things, not to put aside the name of Jesus, but to stand for him, to live for him, to walk with him. We thank you for these voices, these witnesses that help us. Will you help us by your Spirit to live full on for you and so run the race that you've marked out for us? For we are